Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony. This is episode 149, and for those who are who've downloaded an episode for the first time, welcome for the first time. We really appreciate you coming and listening to the show. This episode, I'm going to be flying solo. What I was planning to do is go over a couple of the comics, trade paperbacks that I've been reading recently. The way the weather has been this past week in my city of Toronto, it's been a little bit crazy between the snow, between the extreme cold, a couple of sick days because of it, and I was able to sit at home one of these days this week and just read a ton of comics. Well, a ton of comics to me is three or four trade paperbacks in a day. And I figured, why not discuss it? Some of the stuff that I've read, whether to recommend it, whether you should definitely go pick it up, what's happening or being released on the shelves in the last recent month of January. But before I get into that, what I wanted to do was get into some housekeeping. I got listener email from good buddy of the show, PVAC. He listened to episode 144, where I went on my tirade talking about the latest DC entertainment universe, whatever it's called, DCEU, the Aquaman movie, which was extremely successful, which is awesome. I don't want things to do badly or to fail, and I don't want people to hate stuff. I know that I went on my own tirade of what I thought of the movie, but it's good to see things succeed and people do well with whatever they're, you know, everyone who worked on Aquaman, you know, round of applause. But he responded to the episode. I don't know if he's seen the movie yet, but before we get into the book reviews that I'm going to try to do, let's read PVAC's email. So he titled it More Crazy Ramblings. And what I love about PVAC's emails is that he doesn't, he's descriptive. He gets into it. He's really sharing what he's thinking. I love it. I absolutely love it. So it starts off, "Hey guys, once again, great job all around. Every time I listen, I'm either entertained or feel as if I learned something new." Oh, that's good. "Nice to hear that Lady J is back, while at the same time having Eric Anthony run solo was pretty cool too. Thank you. I'm always a little uncomfortable when I'm flying solo, like episode like this. I don't know how my buddy Adam Chapman does it at Comic Shenanigans. He just presses record and goes for 20, 25 minutes. I have a hard time doing it. But thank you, Pete. I'm happy you enjoyed it. And of course, all the other people who have been on the show when Daff J hasn't been co-hosting with me, I appreciate that a ton. Now on to my ramblings. This is getting back to the email. After listening to episode 144, I had a few thoughts about seahorses and invisible jets. They go as follows. I mentioned how silly Aquaman looks riding seahorses and why Wonder Woman would have an invisible jet. Didn't make sense to me. So here are his theories as regards to Aquaman seahorse. Not having seen the movie as of this writing and not knowing much about the character, you asked why he rides seahorses. I wondered that too, since my early recollections is from the Justice League animated series. But my guess would be that if it's true and he can swim underwater the way Superman flies, then maybe it's his way of toning down his abilities to match whomever he's fighting alongside. Oh, that's so sweet that he would be so thoughtful to do that. Instead of swimming ahead and starting the battle on his own, he chooses to ride a seahorse to keep pace with his fellow combatants while at the same time showing a form of unity, solidarity. And then he refers to a picture from Infinity War where War Machine could clearly fly faster than anybody else can run, but he chose to slow down so he can attack alongside with his friends as a united front. Interesting theory. When I read some of these theories online, or when me and my friends talk about it, I take a moment to step out of that conversation and realize this is so silly. But I love it just the same. I don't know if that's the reason why. It would make sense that Aquaman would use what's at his disposal if he's the king of the sea to, you know, ride on the back of a whale to get somewhere and be a more intimidating, powerful figure. It makes sense to me. I was just nitpicking because I guess my experience with the movie was, I guess I watched it at the wrong time and I just felt silly coming out of there. So I had all these things to nitpick, but that's a solid theory. And in regards to Wonder Woman's jet, Yeah, he says, I too think it's silly that she has a jet since she's a demigod. Maybe it has to do with the fact of the universe she's in? Question mark. For example, at the conclusion of Man of Steel, Superman brings down a satellite that was tracking his movements. Maybe Wonder Woman needed protection from the government's secret organizations who wanted to follow her as well. My thought would be to have Batman design and supply the jet, but its invisibility wouldn't be a man-made cloaking device, but rather whatever ancient power or tech that makes the Mascara invisible. This way, she could use her own flight to travel and go into battle and the jet whenever she wanted to go home, thus protecting the location of Paradise Island. That's not a bad theory. Also, if the jet is designed by Bruce, I'm sick and tired of Bruce Wayne designing absolutely everything. Then maybe it could also serve as a home base of sorts with its own tech whenever she is flying around or as a means to remain in communication with the Justice League while back at home. That's it for now. Looking forward to seeing Captain Marvel and, of course, Avengers Endgame. Until then, all the best, guys. Sincerely, PVAC, a.k.a. 105. I always joke with friends of mine who are listeners that there's only 5 people listening, so PVAC is 1 of 5. secondary adjunct of Unimatrix 5150. I'm not sure what that means, but it goes along with 105. Thanks, Pete. I appreciate the listener email. And of course, your theories are a lot of fun to read and debate with you. I actually looked up the invisible plane. So to answer the question of why she would use an invisible plane, I learned that originally, the original Wonder Woman from before her, her background, her origin changed. After 1985 or 86, there was a different origin of Wonder Woman that came into play, which I think for the most part kind of still exists to an extent. It kind of resonates still. But the original Wonder Woman could not fly. The best she could do was travel on air currents for a certain distance of time, but she couldn't officially fly. So the invisible plane was a creation of hers when she was young, to be an improvement on her mother's planes, which could be shot down in man's world. So the result was an innovation of an invisible plane that could fly at terrific speeds silently and not be detected by hostile forces, thus avoiding unpleasant conflict. And it was portrayed as being transparent. So that was the initial reason for the Wonder Woman invisible plane. The later history, I'm reading this from Wikipedia, just so you people don't think that I know all this stuff off the top of my head. I don't. The later history, in the post-crisis version of the DC Universe, Wonder Woman can actually fly. She has no need for an invisible plane. But when the invisible plane was included in the post-crisis on Infinite Earths version of Wonder Woman, the invisible plane technology was an artificial intelligence that could be used and transformed into any vehicle that the bearer decided. So it could be a jet, a submarine, a motorcycle, horse-drawn chariot, etc., etc. So that's how it was introduced later on in Wonder Woman comic book continuity. But initially, Wonder Woman couldn't fly, so she had an invisible plane. Still kind of silly and ridiculous, but this is a comic book podcast for the most part, so we talk about silly things. And you know what? Again, a big shout out to Pete for sending that email, because it actually made me wonder, like, why the heck does she use an invisible plane? Does it even still exist? Because it's dumb. But that's the reason. There you go. So moving on, we're going to talk about some of the trade paperbacks that I've recently purchased at my local comic book shop, Cyber City Comics. Steels and Bathurst is the major. Steels and Carpenter is the intersection that it's officially on, but it's around the Steels and Bathurst area. If you are looking for a great comic book shop to go to, definitely check out Cyber City Comics. Tell them Eric sent you. They'll know who. They should know which Eric it is. So back to the trades that I was referring to. I have with me the Black Panther from Ta-Nehisi Coates, Volume 6, The Intergalactic Empire of Wakanda, as well as, let me make sure I can reach these here, as well as The Thing and Human Torch, Marvel 2-in-1, Volume 2, which is written and drawn by Chip Zdarsky, Ramon Perez, and Declan Shelvey draws an issue in there as well. That's the Volume 2 of a 12-issue series. And then the third one was The Sentry from Jeff Lemire, and let me make sure I say the artist's name correctly. Let me just flip through this because it wasn't an artist who I had recognized before. Kim Jacinto and Joshua Cassera were the artists on this book. So all Marvel titles. I'm going to go through them. I'm not going to spoil the heck out of them in case, because I want people to potentially read these. Because I am picking these because I recommend them, some more than others. So I'll go in the order that I read them. That's how I'll review it. So the first one that I read the other day on my day off of work was The Sentry. So Jeff Lemire, good old Canadian boy, big hockey fan. I think he's definitely from Ontario. I feel one of the finest comic book creators of this era, this day and age. One of my favorites, most consistent, very prolific. He's done work for DC, Marvel, Valiant, Dark Horse, creator-owned stuff. I don't know how he's able to manage and juggle all of these different titles. He also is an artist as well. Probably most famous for, or gained most of his fame from Essex County, but you know, he's a major player in the comic book world and Canada's own. So I pretty much am willing to check out anything that Jeff Lemire does. And I find that the more high profile the character he works on, it's not usually the best of his stuff. And that's not a knock against him. I think it's more the way that he creates and writes. He needs a certain level of freedom, I find, in what he works with. But when you give him like an X-Men to work on, or a title that requires heavy editing, I don't feel that you get the best of Jeff Lemire. And that's more from an editorial corporate meddling, I'm guessing. Because when I read his Valiant stuff, it's incredible. When I read, you know, his creator-owned, it escapes me now the name of it, but it's one of my favorite books. I can't believe I can't remember. Black Hammer. Black Hammer. One of the best books on comic book shelves right now, not associated with DC or Marvel, creator-owned stuff. Excellent, excellent comic book. But The Sentry is kind of a controversial, divisive character. A lot of people don't care for this character at all, but some people don't mind him. And so I figured Jeff Lemire taking a shot at this character who is relatively a newer creation. He was developed, I think, in 2000 by Paul Jenkins and Jay Lee. He's pretty much a Superman knockoff. He's a solar-powered hero who has the power of 1,000 suns. If he's on your side, he was a member of the Avengers. They gave him like a whole a forgotten history within the Marvel universe that was constantly erased from the memories of the other superheroes that existed during that time. It's a little, it's not extremely confusing, but I don't think I can do a good job at summarizing the history of, I think it's Robert Reynolds is his name. Bob Reynolds is the character who, the alter ego of Sentry. Yes, it is. So he's got the power of 1,000 suns. If he's on your side, it's a wonderful thing. But the caveat with the Sentry is that he's got a dark side to him called the Void. That if the Void comes out, then all hell breaks loose and he's basically unstoppable. So this story picks up with Bob Reynolds / the Sentry on an adventure. You start reading. He's in you know, a typical metropolitan city in comic book world, looks like New York, and he's defeating the Void. He's overcoming it. It wants to take him over, and he has what is, I would, the best way to compare it would be like the Captain Marvel family, like the Shazam family. He's got a sidekick named Scout. He's got a female sidekick named Sentress. And they're all defeating the Void. But what you come to find out is that he's actually in a pocket dimension / universe within his mind that Doctor Strange has created. I think Doctor Strange and Tony Stark have created a device. What is the name of this thing now? Let me flip through here. It's a conflictor. Yeah, so this, he keeps a watch on him. And when he wakes up every morning, he escapes the this pocket dimension where the you know, with the use of the conflictor, he's able to go in and be the sentry and constantly be defeating the void with his sidekicks that he's, you know, from his imagination has chosen to be in there with him. And this helps him to control the void from coming back out into the real world. So he keeps a watch on him every couple of hours or within a day's cycle. He's got to make sure that he gets to the conflictor, taps in, defeats the void. And it's like a mental exercise to keep him sane because of the fact that, like I mentioned before, the void is extremely dangerous. So after he goes through the mental exercise, his day-to-day life is pretty ordinary. He works at a diner with his friend Billy, who, when he was actually the sentry in the real world, Billy was Scout. And now Billy works in the diner with him. He's an amputee. He's lost his arm. Sorely misses the days of being a sidekick. And then the waitress who works in the diner named Jenny, within the conflictor universe of Bob Reynolds' mind, she's the centrist. So he's created this little family of sorts, superhero family of sorts that he can continually defeat the void with. But problems arise when he goes home one day to tap into the conflictor the way he's been instructed to by Doctor Strange and Iron Man, and it's gone missing. And one of his oldest enemies, the Cranio, was one of his classic villains, has returned, and now he's got to go head to head and figure out what's happened to his conflictor and why people are trying to force the void to come back out, because if that should happen, well, all hell breaks loose, like I mentioned. So this is a 5-issue trade paperback, which is a good read. It's pretty quick. It's about $20 Canadian. I'd recommend it because it's a pleasant read. The issue I have with it is because it's 5 issues, and I think it was supposed to be an ongoing series, it's been canceled. So you feel the wrap-up happen pretty quick. And it occurs at a point where you want more of the story. And Jeff Lemire has done something convenient in the sense that he's left a really, really big window open for this story to be... you can return to it. And it doesn't end with a fulfilling ending, I guess due to the fact that it was canceled. So because of that, out of the 3 that I read, I'd probably recommend this the least. Not because it isn't good stuff and the artwork in it doesn't flow well with the story. It does. Everything works well for me. I enjoy the artwork from Jacinto. I enjoy Jeff Lemire's dialoguing and his character interaction and character development, but he never really got a chance to go, you know, even if they gave him 3 more issues to you know, complete an arc. It's really left a wide open, not a plot hole, but this is something that I would hope they return to, because naturally the Bob Reynolds time runs out on him to get back to that pocket universe in his mind to tend to the issues of his multiple personalities, if you will. And the sentry comes out, and over time the void becomes something that he merges with. Spoilers. So a complete version of Bob Reynolds, a mixture of the void and sentry, have manifested themselves. And the Avengers are ready to take him down, and he's saying, listen, there's no reason for you to worry about me right now. Everything's good. I got this under control. And I'm not spoiling the story, but it ends in a way where I hope they return to this. So if you find this book, this trade paperback, perhaps in a secondhand or discounted format, I'd recommend to get it in that regard, even digitally, but to pay full price for this story that kind of feels it unfortunately was not completed to what I feel its potential could be. And again, I think that's due to the century. I don't think it was on anyone's radar to have this book. And a lot of times, books that aren't usually on anybody's radar, or they try to do a book with a character that, like, really, why would they make a Gwenpool book, or why would they do a solo series of The Vision? Well, if you get the right writer, artist team to work on it, you're going to come up with something good. But in order for that to happen, you obviously have to get enough people purchasing it. So for it to go up to 5 issues is a shame. At least if it went up to 8, we'd get a complete story. But you never know. This could be something that they go back to, and then suddenly this story is pertinent. But we'll wait and see. So the next one that I completed yesterday was the Marvel 2-in-1, The Thing and the Human Torch, Volume 2 from Chip Zdarsky and Ramon Perez. And you know, just off the top, this is really cool to have, in the sense that the two creators on this are both Toronto boys, Chip Zdarsky and Ramon Perez, if I'm not mistaken, were two of the founding members of Raid Studios in Toronto. That members like Francis Manapul, who is a star with DC Comics, Scott Hepburn, who has done a lot of work for Marvel Comics, and of course Ramon Perez, who's an Eisner Award winner, Chip Zdarsky, who's working on numerous Marvel titles, as well as some really successful creator-owned stuff, such as Sex Criminals. He's done Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man. Now I think he's moved on to the Invaders. So it's really cool to have these two guys from our city working on a book together at Marvel, of two of the, you know, most legendary characters, if you will, the two of the Fantastic Four. So I guess it should be called the Terrific Two, but Marvel 2-in-1 is perfect. I really, really loved Volume 1 of this series. I couldn't put it down when I read the first trade, the first six issues with Chip Zdarsky and Jim Chung. Jim Chung doesn't return for the second volume, but Ramon Perez does a good job on it. And basically the premise of this series, which was meant to be 12 issues, which I kind of like that it's a full arc planned on, where it's, you know, starting, where they're headed midway through the story, and then, you know, at least it gets a little bow at the end, was that in the Marvel Universe a few years ago, the Fantastic Four, they didn't disband. The leader and his wife, Mr. Fantastic, Reed Richards and Sue Storm, and their children disappeared after a huge apocalyptic event, I guess you could say, where reality had to be restored, and Reed Richards essentially sacrificed his existence in that reality to make sure that he put everything back in its proper place, which was a really good event, actually. It was called Secret Wars. Great read, it's a great read, but you have to kind of have a little bit of background going into it to get the full appreciation for it. But nonetheless, that's a tangent. This is, you know, the aftermath of, there's been no Fantastic Four book for the last couple of years. So with this Marvel 2-in-1, taking two of those characters from the Fantastic Four, bringing them back together, they're searching for Reed Richards and Sue Richards, basically because Johnny Storm has been suffering from a depression, having lost his family, his niece, his nephews, his sister, his brother-in-law. So his purpose in the world is not quite as defined anymore. He doesn't know where he belongs. He doesn't know what his value is. And then, of course, the Thing, who's always kind of struggled with that sense of identity and value and worth because of the tragedy that's happened to him, he wants to pick up his buddy to, you know, give him a little bit of purpose again. So he tells him a lie and says, you know, Reed and Sue are out there. They're actually alive. And Reed has given me this device that Dr. Doom had in his possession, but Dr. Doom doesn't know how to use it. It's called the Multisec, and it's meant for us to dimension hop. That was a gift that Reed left us, for us to still go on adventures together. But because I found out that Reed is alive, he's out there, we can go and find them. So that kind of gives Johnny a revitalized spirit to want to keep going. So they go on these adventures together, hopping different dimensions, coming in contact with different versions of Reed and Sue, but it's not their Reed and Sue. Dr. Doom is involved on the adventure. And since the event where Reed and Sue initially disappeared, Dr. Doom has been a more benevolent character within the Marvel universe. So this Doom, of course, you always think he's up to something, but he's got, it seems to be, benevolent intentions. So in this volume, I was really excited to get back to this adventure and see what was going to happen, how it would wrap up. And I enjoyed it because it's the combination of these two, the banter that they have, the dependency on each other, the revelations that Johnny comes to, you know, realizing that Ben has lied to him now, seeing the people that they've encountered or that they've been traveling with, what their true intentions are. But I feel what's lacking about this, and this is the disappointment for me, is that the Fantastic Four, their official comic relaunched in, I think it was August of 2018, while this was still being published, this book of the Marvel 2-in-1. So somewhere in this trade, the Fantastic Four is actually reunited and brought back together, but it's not explored in this book, nor did I expect it to be revealed in this book. It would always have to be revealed in the actual Fantastic Four title, but I think because that happened somewhere else, this ends on a bit of a different note, and it takes away a bit of the steam that I thought it would have at the end. Still a very enjoyable story, but I just feel some of the happenings of it were a little bit disrupted, and I don't think, again, Chip Zdarsky was able to complete the story in the way he may have liked, kind of what Jeff Lemire suffered with the Sentry. But because this is a 12-issue arc, and it does have a loop and a payoff, it is a good way to get reintroduced to the world of the Fantastic Four. So I would recommend this series, Volume 1 and 2. It is worthwhile. It's just, that's, I'm trying to be fair in giving it praise and the criticism. There's a great annual in here as well that is more Doom-centric, where he encounters a Council of Reeds, once again, that has reestablished itself. That's something in Marvel, in Fantastic Four mythology, a Council of Reed Richards that are either trying to solve every problem that they can encounter, but this council is, their goals are a little bit different, because the first time the Council of Reeds got together from different universes and tried to solve every problem in the world, only more problems were created. That's a episode all on itself. So I recommend this one. I definitely liked Volume 1 a little bit more, but I enjoyed this one as well. It was an easy read, and of course The Thing and Johnny Storm, they're so much fun. I've really learned to appreciate The Thing much more as a character. I wasn't ever a big Fantastic Four fan, but reading some of these, especially this, I gotta say, Chip Zdarsky's Marvel 2-in-1, The Thing and Human Torch, really made me have a desire to read the whole family together, which I've actually gone back and done a lot of. And there's a reason why they are Marvel's first family, and I can't wait. I'm not wishing. I can't wait until Marvel does a proper Fantastic Four movie, because if Fantastic Four is done properly, people, I think, have a very bad taste in their mouth of what the Fantastic Four is based on the movies that have come out from Fox. It doesn't even scratch the surface of how wonderful or how fantastic the Fantastic Four can actually be, because the Marvel Universe begins with them. So imagine if the whole Marvel Universe was funneled through the Fantastic Four. Believe it or not, it would be even better than what we have now, I think. That's my opinion. Moving on. The last book that I read the other day was the Volume 6 of The Black Panther from Ta-Nehisi Coates and Daniel Acuna on art. That's funny. Daniel Acuna said that. Funny. The Intergalactic Empire of Wakanda, Part 1. So this is a very different premise for the Black Panther, who we all know, based on the movie that everyone, I imagine, has watched up to this point, is the king of an African nation, Wakanda, that is technologically way ahead of every other country on the planet. It's just been kept a secret. I'm just opening up the book right now, trying not to make too much noise. But this is going in a very different direction, because as much as the Black Panther's vibranium technology has powered the nation and is the most valuable, I don't think it's a metal, but the most valuable resource on Earth, but it is an alien technology, his stories have always been pretty much on this planet. He's done adventures with the Avengers. He's been involved in you know, intergalactic matters. But this one actually takes T'Challa out there, in this empire of Wakanda that is in space. So I'm going to read the back of the book to you guys to give you the best synopsis, because I don't know if I could. For years, T'Challa has protected Wakanda from all invaders. Now he will discover his kingdom is much bigger than he ever dreamed. Across the vast multiverse lies an empire founded in T'Challa's name. Now learn the truth behind the intergalactic empire of Wakanda. A Panther story unlike any other begins with T'Challa as a stranger in a strange land with no memory of his past, only the suffering of a present spent toiling in the vibranium mines. But all hope is not lost. A rebellion is growing, and they have a plan. But who will lead these lost citizens? Where is the Black Panther? And what is the Makran Shard? I love this book. It was so much fun. I wasn't sure about it when I picked it up. In single issue form. I read the first issue because, again, you know, Marvel's always relaunching and renumbering and going in a different direction to try to, almost like a television show with seasons, right? Comics are kind of published in that way. How do you know where to start? And then it started with a new number one. I had no idea why T'Challa was now in space or why he didn't even know why he was there. I was kind of confused when I read the first issue. And this trade is number 6. So I feel like I read the first 3 trades, the first 12 issues of this series, enjoyed it, but the Black Panther series branched off into Black Panther and the crew and the world of Wakanda and all these other miniseries being written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is, you know, a celebrated writer, a best-selling author outside of the world of comics. So to have him be writing the Black Panther has been, you know, a real treat in a lot of ways. But I think the first volume, I read the big hardcover volume of the Black Panther series with him and Brian Stelfreeze on art duties. And it was good, but it wasn't the best Black Panther I had ever read. This is up there, though. And if you haven't read the first 5, if you've only watched the movie of the Black Panther, you can buy this volume 6 and get right into it, not having to worry about anything that's happened before. That's, I think, how it's been designed and how well it reads. So if you like Star Wars, if you have read perhaps, I would say like Valiant's Exo Man of War, which I'm a big fan of, this is right up your alley. It's a story of, you know, T'Challa having found himself be a slave in an intergalactic empire like that is honoring his name and his history, not knowing why he's there, not really remembering who he is and where he comes from. So he's putting the pieces together as you're trying to put the pieces together. But there is the legend of T'Challa is referred to throughout the book. The people name their children based off of T'Challa, but they don't realize that he is the one that is of legend. So there's, after issue 1, it actually says, which was reassuring to me, which helped me enjoy the rest of the book, it says, "Welcome to the Intergalactic Empire of Wakanda. We're sure you have lots of questions," which I did. "How did T'Challa get here? Is that really Nakia and M'Baku?" So M'Baku is the character from the Black Panther movie who's part of the Gorilla Tribe, who is enlisted to help Black Panther in the Avengers Infinity War. We all know who M'Baku is. And Nakia is, I think, his love interest, if I'm not mistaken. My memory is good, and sometimes it's not good. So they're there, but is this the ones that we know? Has no one heard of this empire before? How has no one ever heard of this empire before? Hang tight. It's all part of the journey. Here's a little introduction by Ta-Nehisi Coates to some of the factions and races who appear in this issue, along with Daniel Acuna's gorgeous design. So each issue gives you a little bit more background as you're reading the story, figuring out what's happening in the Intergalactic Empire, what's happening to T'Challa as far as he's discovering who he is. He's living his life as though he's got a death wish because his identity is lost to him. But he was part of the... It's like a caste system in this current reality of T'Challa. And he's part of the caste system that is basically, I don't want to misquote it. Let me get to the... So there's a page here at the end of issue 1, like I was mentioning to you before. And it goes through all of the different caste systems within the empire. So there's the Imperials, the highest caste of the Wakandans. They claim to be the blood of the descendants of the founders of the intergalactic empire. And I think Najadaka, which is Eric Killmonger in the comics and the movie, is the king of the empire. He's the emperor, essentially. So is it the one that we know? Well, we're not sure. We're figuring that out. You've got the Miners, who are also known as the Nameless. They're the subjects of the Empire condemned to slavery in the Vibranium mines. So Vibranium's still a big part of this. The Nameless have been mind wiped. They know nothing of their original history, which seems to be where T'Challa is currently living and is found. Then you have the Askari, who are the police force of the Empire and the arm of the Wakandan slave trade. They, as a caste, they're hated by the Miners and denigrated by the Imperials. So they're kind of in that middle portion where they're useful, but they're not respected by either those above them or below them. And then you have the Rebels, who are known as the Maroons. And they are the ones who are fighting back. They're basically the rebellion or the resistance, that you, if you want to look at it in a Star Wars frame of mind to kind of put the pieces together. So the Maroons go to one of the mining fields, the Vibranium mining fields, where T'Challa is, and they rescue a number of people there. T'Challa is amongst them, and so he joins the ranks of the Maroons. He's nameless, but through the way that he fights, the way that he encounters the Empire when they're battling, he's kind of like a Han Solo or Luke Skywalker. He's got a bit of a death wish, almost like a Poe Dameron, if you will, in the way that he, because there's spaceships in this. This is a real galaxy adventure. You know, I keep using the word intergalactic, but it really is. There's all kinds of sci-fi goodness in this book with a mixture of that classic Black Panther mythology involved in it. And as the story is going on, you're putting pieces together. T'Challa is still struggling, trying to figure out who he is. But by the way that he conducts himself, people are starting to realize that he is the king of legend. There's everything, all evidence is pointing towards that. I don't want to get into any of the more spoilers about it. I just want to set up that world. And I highly recommend people pick this up. It's a ton of fun. I love Daniel Acuna's art in it. It seems very simple and basic, almost like he was able to do it fast, but at the same time, very detailed, and he completely captures the mood that you're supposed to be feeling with this book, which I think is, you can look at someone's art and look at how beautiful everything is drawn and how tight the lines are, and it's just a great image, but then there's got to be the storytelling, the movement of it all. Like when you're going through the pages where T'Challa is escaping attacks or he's flying a spaceship, or I guess I want to say TIE fighter, but it's not a TIE fighter, but in those type of scenes, very Star Wars-esque, you feel it. You feel the speed of it. You feel the force of things being the escapes and the close calls and all of those things. The only thing missing is like the literal sound effects coming from the page at times. So I really enjoy his artwork. It's completely in the zone for it. Like that escape aspect of it, you're in it. And I highly recommend this book. But this is out of the three, this is the one that I would recommend the most. Hit up your local comic book shop, pick this up. You could do it digitally if that's what you prefer. But that Black Panther, I think it's a better beginning to out of all the Ta-Nehisi Coates stuff thus far. And I can't wait for the next volume of this. And I hope it doesn't get disrupted by any sort of... I mean, there's going to be an Avengers movie coming and eventually another Black Panther movie coming. I hope this story is able to be completed and you get it comes to the point where you'll have a nice collected volume of this, because I really feel this book, if it hits all the marks and it sticks the landing, it could go down as a really great story, period. Not a Black Panther story, just a really great story, period. And I hope Acuna stays on the book with the art, because there's nothing quite as satisfying as having a full story drawn and told by the same team. I think there's one issue in here that's a fill-in, and it does it it's okay that it, you have this one fill-in, because where the story goes, it's in a different type of a setting and dealing with a different character. So it lends itself well to Daniel Acuña taking a break for the last issue of this arc and making you anticipate what's going to happen next. But it's a wonderful world that's been created and designed by the Ta-Nehisi Coates and Daniel Acuña. So those three, Black Panther number one, I put the Marvel 2-in-1 at number two recommendation, and the Century at number three, but all very good reads, solid stuff. You know, Marvel catches a lot of slack for stuff that they're putting on the shelf, but this is good stuff. This has been 40 minutes of me rambling. I hope that you're still listening and you enjoyed it, and I've perhaps given you some good recommendations to hit up a comic book store and check out some stuff. Maybe this is something, I'm not going to make a promise, but something I can do once a month with the stuff that I read that's been recently put on the shelf or just recently released. Maybe something that's older that I've come around to reading and I want to recommend. But it's good to be able to have good stuff to share instead of criticizing movies that I didn't like. So thank you again for listening. Definitely check out the podcasts of my buddies. You got Fastball Special from my buddy Martin Slam Duncan, as well as the Comic Shenanigans from Adam Chapman, who does this like three times a week. I don't know how he does it, but he's a pro at it. Thank you for listening. Email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Follow us on Facebook. Leave a rate and review us on iTunes. Every little bit helps. And also, before I go, check out the Kickstarter for Cauldron. That was our last episode. It's been funded, so you know that you're going to get good product. So definitely check out the Cauldron Kickstarter. Get behind it. And thank you to everyone who listened to that. I appreciate it very much. This is Eric Anthony of the Cave of Solitude. We'll be back soon with episode 150, which I don't know what it's going to be, but the next one will be 150, so stay tuned.